Hello, my name is Christine Bunch, and I spent 17 years in prison for a crime I didn't commit.
Hi, this is Brooke, and I'm here with DeMarco, and you're listening to Actual Innocence. We're a podcast bringing awareness to wrongful conviction and issues in the justice system. So how are you doing this week, DeMarco?
Oh, I'm doing wonderful. I had a chance to hang out with my mom today, and, you know, spending time with my mom is always a pleasure because, you know, we have so much time to make up for. So I enjoy spending time with her, and she keeps me laughing.
How's your new dog doing?
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you about Abby. My mom wanted the babysitter. She has a little dog, so I let her keep Abby over there with her dog, and now she don't want to give Abby back.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so Abby has two homes.
I need to give credit to DeMarco because he arranged today's interview with Christine. And I'm actually a little bit ashamed to admit that I didn't know about Christine's case, and I even live in the same state. So, DeMarco, thank you so much for reaching out to her and asking her to be on the show.
Oh, no problem.
So, before we continue on to the trivia section, we're going to hear from our first sponsor. Just a reminder that supporting our sponsors helps to support our show. If you can't financially support them, it's still really helpful to give them a shout out on social media and thank them for sponsoring us.
I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way I found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere, and with just a few taps, I can instantly find seats. I actually just used the app to buy tickets to Anastasia while visiting my friends at Audioboom in New York. SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. It saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get you the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater, like Anastasia. Best of all, our listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code ACTUAL today. That's promo code ACTUAL for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase.
DeMarco, are you ready for this week's trivia questions?
Yes, I am.
I think this is such a great way for our listeners to learn facts about wrongful conviction in kind of a interesting sort of way. This week's question came from the June 7th, 2016 edition of Time magazine. And the question, it's a multiple choice one. What percentage of women who are wrongly convicted are convicted for a crime that didn't occur? Basically, there was no crime, but they were blamed for the outcome of the not crime. So A is 25%, B is 50%, C is 67%, or D is 78%.
Well, since I did read somewhere that it was a 700%, you know, increase the chances of, you know, 700%. I read somewhere. Matter of fact, I have it in my phone, but, you know, I'm going to say B. No. Hold on. I'm going to say D.
So the answer is C. It's 67%, or two-thirds of women who are wrongly convicted are convicted of a crime that wasn't even a crime. And in Christine's story, as you know, that the listeners will hear in just a few minutes, that's an example. Also, Julie Baumer in episode 104 and Maria Shepherd in episode 119. Why do you think the number is so high for women?
I wouldn't imagine that it was that high.
So one more question. DNA is responsible for 25% of the men who are exonerated. What percentage of women do you think are exonerated by DNA?
I don't think women as high as men, so I'm going to say 13%.
You're really close. It's 7%. Do you have any idea why there's such a big gap between the genders?
No, why is that?
This isn't a definite, but I talked to an attorney who works at an Innocence Network agency, and he told me that in the case of sexually motivated crimes, women have less biological material that would be left behind. And so that means there's less evidence that could be tested for DNA. I just wondered if you could give me a little bit of history on how you met Christine and why you asked her to be on the show.
I met Christine last summer over Michelle Murphy's house, and Michelle is another exoneree. And me, Michelle, Malcolm, and Christine, and some other people that Michelle knew that stayed in her apartment building, we all hung out. And, you know, we could relate to each other. And that's why we all reached out to each other. And, you know, since Michelle is here in Tulsa, and, you know, we could relate. Like Christine said, you know, we don't feel, we're not as embarrassed to ask one another, you know, how do you do this or how is that done or, you know, but when people that hadn't been in our situation, when you ask them, I feel like they look at me funny, you know, it's like, what? You don't know how to do this or you don't know how to, come on, man. But, you know, because people, they see me and they be like, you know, they don't really, people don't think that I've been locked up, you know, because how I do carry myself. But, you know, I ask questions, you know, I'm doing things and, you know, and if I don't know it, I'm going to ask, you know. We all met each other and hung out and it was cool.
Growing up, I was in a small town outside Connersville, Indiana. And it was just my mom, my dad, and my baby brother. And, I mean, I grew up in that small community and went to Brownies and was in the choir and made the A honor roll and loved it.
We had very similar childhoods up to that A honor roll part.
Yeah. I mean, I felt at home there. It was real comfortable. And everybody that I was in school with, I'd grown up with. We went to kindergarten together and we did the same after school activities. And when we had sleepovers, it was just, you know, the same girls and we bounced from each other's houses and it was very comfortable. And then my parents divorced when I was 10. And I guess it didn't really affect me until my mom remarried and she moved us to Greensburg, Indiana. And when we got there, I was just getting ready to turn a teenager and I was very angry. I didn't want to go to school. I didn't want to do anything. I wanted to be back with my friends. Even if I lived with my dad, I still wouldn't be with the same group of people because he had moved. So it was a very rough time. And I think that's when, you know, I started skipping school and hanging out with the wrong crowd. My grades were non-existent and I just didn't care.
Let's fast forward a little bit to the beginning of the year of 1995. What was your life like before all of this happened?
Before all this happened, I was a single mom. I found out right before I turned 18 that I was pregnant with Tony. And that was a total accident. I was on the pill and I'd gotten sick and had to be on antibiotics. And I didn't realize that that rendered the pill ineffective sometimes. So when I found out I was pregnant, I decided that I was going to turn things around. And I went in and took the GED test and got my GED. And I started going to school and working full time. And I knew that it was going to be a challenge, but I wanted to give him the best that I could.
So were you still living in that same community?
I was still in Greensburg, yes. It was just, you know, and kind of an endless runaround. In 1995, I was 20 and I had an almost 3-year-old and I worked and I went to school and the rest of the time was spent doing things with my kid and probably not the same things that everybody else did because I was still, you know, just coming out of those teenage years. So he hung out with me and my friends and went to the mall shopping and wore matching t-shirts and hats and tennis shoes and little cutesy stuff. And he was really my whole world.
So can you tell me what happened on June 30th in 1995?
I woke up and I don't really know what woke me up. And there was smoke in the house, but it didn't, when you wake up to those kind of things, what's happening doesn't really register correctly. And so I remember thinking, God, it's really foggy outside. It didn't penetrate that it was smoke and there was fire. And then you see the flames and you choke and you go into full panic mode. And I'm trying to hit it. I tried to hit the fire with a pillow and it caught on fire. And I tried to smother it with a blanket and it just melted on top of it. And so I ran and I tried to find a fire extinguisher and I couldn't. And I couldn't get into the room where my baby was. So I ran out screaming for my neighbors to come help me. And at the front of the house, I picked up his tricycle and I smashed it into the window. And I tried to climb into the window so that I could get him. And my neighbor pulled me out and told me that it was too late because the flames were coming through the roof at that time. And so we heard the sirens from the fire department. And they got there and I went to an ambulance and I waited because I just knew they were going to find him and give him some oxygen and he was going to be okay. And he wasn't.
So you go to the hospital and at what point does it become real? I understand the feeling of they're going to give him some oxygen and he's going to be okay. Like, when did it sink in, do you think?
I think it sunk in when my dad came into the emergency room and I told him that they kept telling me that he was gone. And he said, he is. And I looked at him and said, you don't know what that feels like. And he squeezed my hand and said, I know a little because the whole way here, I didn't know if my baby made it out either.
At some point, the police or law enforcement decide to investigate this fire as an arson. Do you know what made them do that?
According to them, an hour and a half after the fire, they decided that there were pour patterns and concrete spalling and charred glass. And they have been taught repeatedly that those are indicators of arson.
I wish you could see me rolling my eyes on your behalf right now.
That's what started them down the path.
What was your interaction with the police like?
Well, they started questioning me immediately. I was still in the emergency room. I hadn't even been put into a regular room yet. And they were there to question me. And my dad, I remember my dad saying, isn't this a little soon? Why are you in here? She hasn't even gotten to her room yet. And so they left. And then later they were in my room and they told me that they had determined that it was gasoline and that somebody had intentionally come in and poured it everywhere. And they wanted to know what my interactions were like with my family and friends. And who would do such a thing to me. So essentially in that moment, you took every support person that I would have had after this tragedy and made me look at them like a suspect. I was really naive and had no clue that they didn't know whether or not it was gasoline at that point, and you didn't know whether or not it was arson at that point.
I'd never been in trouble with the law, and I always thought, you trust the police officers. So I believed what they were saying.
So you were at the hospital when they first interrogated you, when they first confronted you?
I mean, it's all almost like a dreamlike quality, because I didn't realize the effects of carbon monoxide. And so there's lots of pieces that are just seem kind of fuzzy and out of focus. Like you can just close your eyes and pretend it was all a bad dream.
And you had just experienced a huge trauma too. I mean, trauma distorts your perception of things.
Well, yeah. And so they left, and after they left, I'm just sitting in that room, and all I can see and all I can smell is fire. And so I want to leave. And so my mom checks me out of there, and I tell her that I want to go home because I need to see something of my babies. I want to see something. And so she takes me home, and I realize that there's nothing left. So I go over to my babysitter's, Tom, and Tom was like an adopted dad to me, and he babysat my son while I was at work in school. And I stayed at his house with my baby's clothes and all of his toys because I wanted to smell him and hold on to him. And then that night, they called me to the police station at 11:30 at night. And so I had to go in there in borrowed clothes and barefoot because I literally had nothing. I lost everything in the fire. And that's when it clicked for me that they were looking at me like a suspect, because they started asking me about insurance on the house and life insurance on my son. And it was all ridiculous to me. I mean, I'm 20. I don't have insurance on my car, let alone my child. You don't think anything like that can ever happen. There certainly wasn't insurance on the house. And so there was three of them in this little room that they had me shut off into. And they're just screaming at me for me to tell them what happened and tell them what I did and tell them the reasons behind it. And I just kept saying I didn't. So when I started screaming back at them, my mom heard, and she opened the door and said, "This is done. I'm taking her home."
At any point did you ask for an attorney?
No. I was naive enough to think the innocent people don't need attorneys.
I've heard that in so many of these interviews. I didn't do it, so I didn't need an attorney because I was innocent.
I felt the same way. So what was your trial like?
My trial was a lot of fire investigators that were giving different versions of where they thought the fire started, what they believed the accelerants were. And I didn't testify because my dad said he felt like I was already on the edge of a nervous breakdown, and my lawyer had already traumatized me by showing me the autopsy photos and telling me they were going to be part of my trial.
I'm just curious, how long after the fire, when did they arrest you?
I buried my son July 3rd, and I was arrested July 5th, so 5 days.
Warby Parker has quickly become one of my favorite sponsors. Not only do they make and sell eyeglasses, but they also help distribute eyeglasses to those in need. A couple of months ago, I found myself desperately in need of a pair of glasses. I'd been working on 3 podcasts at the same time. My eyes were strained, and I later learned that I'd been using the wrong prescription for the past 2 years. It was making getting my podcast done on time almost impossible. Then, Warby Parker showed up in my inbox as a potential new sponsor. My eyes are important to me, so I wanted to try them out first before accepting their sponsorship. They have this free try-on program. You just go to their website and order 5 pair of glasses, and they send them to you, and you can try them on. When you decide which frames you want, After you decide which pair you want, you just use the included label and put them back in the box that they came in. I handed them right to my mail carrier. I found two pair that I really liked, but I was afraid they were going to be too much for my paycheck-to-paycheck lifestyle. Then, my eye doctor told me that the pair I liked in his office was over $500. With Warby Parker, the glasses started at only $95, including the lenses and the special coatings. I also learned that not only was I getting a new pair of glasses, but when I made my purchase, someone in need was getting a pair for free. Two pair of glasses for less than the fourth of the ones at my doctor's office. It was amazing. Like I said, I went to their website to order my glasses, but I've discovered that they also have an iTunes app. To visit Warby Parker and order your try-on kit, go to warbyparker.com/actual. One more time, that's warbyparker.com/actual, and there'll be a link in the show notes.
And what were the charges?
The charges were murder and arson.
What evidence did the prosecution present?
He presented an ATF report that said that there was a heavy petroleum distillate found in several samples.
Can you tell me what is ATF?
Alcohol, tobacco, and firearms.
Okay.
So a heavy petroleum distillate could have either been kerosene, Jet A aviation fuel, or number one fuel oil. So they presented that there was accelerant found in my son's bedroom, and that report was presented to my jury. Then he had tried to say that I had locked my son in his bedroom, and then they discovered during their investigation that in truth there wasn't a door in that doorway. So a fireman who had went in to recover Tony's body changed between pre-trial and trial. Pre-trial, he said that he had had to go over a ceiling joist that had fallen from the ceiling down onto the wall, and he changed that to say no, he had to crawl over a chair that I'd shoved in the doorway so my son couldn't get out.
I'm really interested in hearing about the junk science that they presented. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, that was the pour pattern and the concrete falling and charred glass. So those things have been around for years, and arson investigators learned on the job. So the previous arson investigator would walk them in and tell them, do you see these patterns on the floor? That's a pour pattern. Or that's a V pattern on the wall made from smoke. Or the way the glass shattered, that is an indicator of arson. Where in truth, those have since been disproven because so many of our materials now are synthetics. So those don't really burn. They melt and they pool. And when they pool, it's usually in the path you walk the most in your house. So like my pattern came from the front door over into the living room and over into the kitchen where people normally walk when they come in and out of the house.
What was your defense like?
My defense was he brought in another fire expert, and he talked about something called rapid combustion. And so he said the place filled with gases. And then when I ran out the door and then essentially busted out the window to get in, that the oxygen came rushing in and all those gases ignited at once.
Did you have a public defender or a paid attorney?
Public defender.
How long did your trial last?
My trial lasted 4 days, and they deliberated 4 hours.
And what sentence did you get? How much time did you receive?
I received 60 years for the murder, 50 years for the arson, and then he combined the two and ran them concurrent. So 60 years altogether.
Can you tell me a little bit about how was prison Like, what was prison like for you?
Prison was really scary, I thought, when I first got there, because I didn't know what to expect. And in the jail, they were very mean to me, telling me all kinds of stories about it. When I got there and went through the intake part of it, it was very hard because everybody knew about my case. It had been on the news and they'd read about it in the paper. So they didn't talk to me. And if they did talk to me, it was to tell me I shouldn't be asking questions. You know, baby killers shouldn't ask anything and baby killers shouldn't be seen, that type of thing. So it was really hard. And I was 6 months pregnant when I was at the prison. So that made it even worse, the stress and being sick and uncertain of the future.
How was your medical care?
The medical care inside the facility was good, but in the jail, it wasn't really good, which was why they sent me to the maximum security facility so that I would be closer to the hospital and they could deal with somebody that was pregnant.
I know that must have been hard being pregnant in there, huh?
It was, but I had been arrested July 5th, and the end of October, I was released on bail because the test results come back and showed that it wasn't gasoline. So my judge gave me a bond, which I thought that means they can see I'm innocent. And I got out and kind of just spiraled out of control. I mean, I didn't have anything. Tony had been it for me. So I drank a whole lot and I did a whole lot of drugs. And my philosophy was kind of, if I don't wake up, it's no big deal. And in that risky behavior, I started getting sick and I went to the doctor and found out that I was pregnant. And that was my wake-up call, that I needed to pull my life together. It was also kind of one of those moments where you realize God didn't take all of your blessings away. You still had something worth fighting for.
What were your options, you know, being pregnant in prison, knowing, you know, after the baby was born, did you have a say in what happened?
Well, when I first got there, I didn't think that I was going to, because when I was sentenced, my judge actually threw up my pregnancy at me and said, I see that you've managed to impregnate yourself, and I'm sure you did that to get leniency from this court. So he went on to say that I would never see that child, and that child would become a ward of the state. When I got to prison, I immediately went to the law library to see if that was true and if he could do that and how I could fight it. And the judge never issued an order stating that. So I didn't have to fight it. I could give Trent up for adoption when he was born, or I could put him with my family. And I believed that I was innocent and I was going to come home. So I put him with my family.
So when you gave birth to your child, you gave him to your family for them to care for?
Yes.
How were your relationships affected with your family, like being in prison?
I mean, essentially, they all just kind of dropped off. I had my mom, who had my brother, and my mom is disabled. So my little brother, when I got convicted, he was 17. He quit school and started working 3 jobs, and he took care of my mother and my son, and he took care of me. It was really important to him that I didn't ask anybody in there for anything. He said, you don't want to become indebted ever. And so basically the two of them were the ones I saw the most, and my son. They had him there every week.
They came to visit you every week?
Yes.
So I read that in June of 1998, your case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court affirmed the conviction. Were you hopeful that your conviction was going to be overturned?
Yes. I told everybody when it goes to through appeals, I'm gonna get out. I'm gonna walk out of here. Everything's gonna be great. I'm gonna be home. And it just doesn't work out like that. When I received it, and the only thing they did, they affirmed it, but they also said that I couldn't be charged with murder and arson. So they vacated the arson charge and reworded the murder charge to include arson.
You were eventually in contact with the Center for Wrongful Convictions. I just wondered how that happened, how that connection was made.
Well, in truth, I got a local attorney to take on my case first. I had befriended a pregnant girl in there because when I got out of intake, I met a lot of really nice people and they watched out for me because I was pregnant. So when other girls were coming in pregnant, I knew what that was like. And the more time I spent around this girl, Heather was like, you know, you need an attorney. You need to fight this. And I was like, you know, I write letters every week and some of them never answer and other ones want $50,000 cash up front. I can't afford that. And she said, why don't you talk to my attorney? So I wrote a letter to her attorney and Hillary made it to where I could make payments every month out of my own state pay. So I worked 2 and 3 jobs so I could send her the most. She read through everything and told me she believed I was innocent, but she didn't know, you know, how she was going to prove it. She said, we need a lot of money.
How did that feel for her to say that? Like that she believed you?
That was like the first shining moment that I saw a light at the end of the tunnel. Because this is somebody that doesn't know me and doesn't know anything about me. She just read everything they said about me. And she said, I believe you. So that was like, I don't know. I guess it just fueled my hope and my passion. At that point, I would start sending her stuff on different arson investigators. And we got Richard Rory to give us 20 hours pro bono. And he works out of Maryland. So he gave us his forensic toxicologist, Jamie McAllister. And at that point, I thought, oh, something's going to happen. And 20 hours sounds like a lot. It's not. So we kind of were spinning our wheels. And one of the church volunteers that came into the prison, I worked in the chapel. And the chaplain told her that she was really worried about me, that she knew I was fighting this and spending all my free time in the law library. And she just thought I could use some extra support. And when I met Betsy, I told her my story, and Betsy is the one essentially that took it to Northwestern Center on Wrongful Convictions and kept calling and bugging them until they took a look at my case.
This episode was supposed to have a third sponsor, but it doesn't, and I thought you might be interested in understanding why. I know sometimes ads feel inconvenient to a lot of listeners. I'm a listener too. The thing that I wanted you to know is that on any podcast that you hear my voice on as one of the hosts, that podcast only uses sponsors that we think are a good fit. If a sponsor doesn't meet our standards or advertises a product or service that could be counterproductive to helping people, we politely decline their sponsorship. We want you to know that we value you as a listener and your time, and we'll never share sponsors with you that we don't believe in.
So I'm talking to you now. What were the steps that they took, that you took to get your innocence, to be exonerated?
Well, when they first came in, because there was so many other things that I had done, I told Jane Raley, she was my primary attorney, that we needed to get the ATF file. And she just kind of looked at me and I said, look, I said, I put in a Freedom of Information Act out of the law library. And of course, they ignored it. I said, but I have done a lot of research and I've talked to a lot of fire investigators. And I believe there's something in that report and I need to see it. And I said, I already got my medical records so that you could see they never tested me for carbon monoxide poisoning. I said, my nightgown was in there. And I said, that tested negative. And if I'd spilled gallons of stuff around, clearly I think there would have been something on me. And I said, the other thing is, I said, we have this girl, Jamie McAllister, who's working on things for free, but she could really be beneficial. So the big smoking gun came, I guess, of course, when they got the ATF file, because they did put in a federal subpoena for that, and discovered that an altered document was used to convict me. And the original document showed no accelerant in my son's room. There were three faint traces in the wood and a small circle in the living room and for kerosene. And the previous owner had already testified that he'd spilled kerosene there. All the other places they said had tested positive or something were all negative.
I feel so angry on your behalf.
Did they figure out who altered that document?
They did. His name is William Kennard, and he's deceased. He died a year before I was released. Mm-hmm. And right now, that's a big part of my civil suit, because, of course, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, even though they're a law enforcement agency, are trying to say that this man who was working for them should not be considered law enforcement and therefore can't be held culpable for changing that report.
This document that you'd been trying to get on your own, you know, from the Freedom of Information Act, finally set you free when you had the big guys on your side.
Yes, that and Jamie McAllister, she was actually the new evidence in my post-conviction release. She is a forensic toxicologist. And so all of her testing was done off of my son's autopsy. And they rushed that through, I think, looking for injuries, and you found none. But what you did find was that he reached an 85% carbon monoxide level. So he was never burnt. He was essentially asleep before the flames ever started. So what she does is run tests to see how you can build up that high of a carbon monoxide level. And with an arson, it burns so fast, it doesn't give off enough carbon monoxide to do that. But if it was an electrical fire in the wall or the ceiling, it smolders for a very long time and gives off those poisonous gases before it ignites.
So was the cause of the fire determined?
Cause of the fire is still undetermined, but she believes it was an accidental fire.
So I wrote down this date, August 8th, 2012, that the Indiana Supreme Court said that you get a new trial.
Yes.
How did that feel?
It was incredible. I thought, you know, this is it. I'm going back to court. They're going to hear all this new evidence. They're going to see everything my lawyers pulled out. They even found a trial photograph and blew it up and proved that there was not a chair in the doorway at all. There was nothing in that doorway. So I thought, everybody's going to get to hear this evidence, and I'm going to be free. And everybody's going to know that I'm innocent. But my trial judge decided that he was going on vacation as soon as that order came out. And so he put in for a month-long vacation. And the pro temp judge didn't want to do anything, so they left me sit in the prison. So at that point, I'm essentially in a prison within a prison, because since I don't have a conviction, I was a liability. So I wasn't allowed to go off the dorm. I wasn't allowed to really mingle a whole lot with anybody, because they were worried that something could happen to me and I'm an unconvicted person in here. So my attorneys had to go back to the appellate court and get them to issue an order for them to transfer me out of the prison and back to county. So my bail, which they didn't return to my family, could either be reinstated, they could grant me a new bail, or they could release me on my own recognizance. And that finally happened August 22nd of 2012. And I walked out.
So I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask the question anyway. How did that new trial go?
we were preparing for it, but they dismissed all charges December 18th of 2012.
I can't imagine how that felt. Many years later, people finally, like legally, you were the innocent person that you always knew that you had been. How did that feel?
Technically, I was kind of a mixed bag. I mean, I was thrilled that I was finally free and exonerated. But on the flip side of that, I wanted that day in court. I wanted people to hear my truth and know that I truly was innocent and hear a jury of my peers say not guilty.
I totally understand that. Actually, to be honest, that's part of the reason why this podcast exists. Several people have told me that this is the first time I've been able to tell my own story and know that people are listening. So, Trent, were you reunited with him when you were exonerated?
I was. He was there.
How old was he?
16.
16. So how did it feel to transition from being in prison to having a teenager?
I mean, in some aspects, it's good. It's hard to transition after such a big gap and with so many changes in the world. I mean, technology and just new things, and I was very scared and intimidated. But having my baby brother and Trent, I mean, that kept me, I think, pushing forward to be connected and understand everything they knew and enjoyed. I mean, my first night out, Trent showed me how to get on Facebook and laughed at me taking a profile picture for the first time. And he laughed when he heard me talk to Jane Rayleigh because she wasn't there for my release. She was taking her son to see a college. And so she called me on a cell phone and she said, "How are you feeling?" And I was like, "Oh my God, I'm talking to you on the smallest little black box I've ever seen in my life. And I can't believe it.
How old is Trent now?
Trent is 21.
So what are you doing now?
What am I doing now?
Yes, how are you?
Well, I am advocating wherever they ask me to go advocate. The last place I went was Wyoming. They have a 2-year rule for new evidence. So sharing my case and letting people know that if I'd had a 2-year restriction, I'd still be sitting in prison innocent. I don't think there should be any stipulations on new evidence. When somebody says, "I have something to exonerate me," we should have an open door to the courtroom so they can go do that. So that didn't end with them saying, "Yes, we're going to do it." But it did end with several people saying, you know, we need to change this bill up a little bit and have some more discussions and really try to push it through. So I felt like that was very positive. I'm getting ready to help with the compensation bill that they're pushing through in Indiana. I would like to see that go through, even if it isn't retroactive and only helps new people when they get out. It's at least something. And I run a non-for-profit organization that I started with fellow exoneree Juan Rivera. And I built that baby up from the ground up.
And that's the organization that you're the director for, right?
Yes, it's called Just Is for Just Us.
I love the name.
Thanks. We thought when you come out, the situation just is. I mean, you can't give somebody back that time. You can't give them back what they lost. I mean, it just is. And hopefully we can take all of us together and build a community to help people with those transition issues. I tell everyone I was so embarrassed. I'm 39 years old when I get out and I go with my brother to see a movie and I didn't know how to turn on the water in the bathroom because they took away the knobs. So it took me almost 10 minutes to finally hit a sensor so the water came on. And when I came out, I was in tears. It was stressful. And that's something you don't want to say to just everybody, but to another exoneree. They get it. They understand.
I totally get it because I was clueless as just as you were. And I felt, you know, I was embarrassed and I felt a little dumb.
Exactly. And like, I've been out 5 years and self-checkouts still bother me. I don't know who's watching me or who's talking to me. And that makes me so uncomfortable because I feel like there's a guard somewhere in a little box looking at me and getting ready to say something.
I've been walking and I've been hearing and I look up and I'm like, yes, did you say? And people have these earpieces and I'm thinking they talking to me, but they're not. They're on their phone.
I know, I do that too.
So the purpose of your organization is to unite exonerees. Is that, am I understanding correctly?
Not specifically exonerees, although I do hope that. Like I have right now, we're active in Indiana and Illinois. So my goal is hopefully once all the different programs and lawyers know that we're here, when somebody's released, they can call and we can have an exoneree over there to meet that person when they come out and say, hey, here's our contact information. We've been there. We've been through it. You have support. And then just kind of assess their needs. So if they don't have a place to go, I mean, I literally came out with my prison uniform and a pair of white tennis shoes. That's all I had. There was no money. There was no clothes. There was no anything. And thank God I had a family, my brother, who stepped up and said, no, we'll get you whatever you need. And my community, people that I'd met in prison and helped with their organizations, they stepped up. And so I had a dentist to help me and somebody to do my hair and countless things that you can't really explain to anybody, you know, unless you've been there. Hey, I don't know where to go or what I'm supposed to do or who I contact. And I have no insurance. I have no connections. So our organization literally tells everybody, you have something to give, whether it's time to show somebody how to do their email or take somebody on the bus for the first time, take them to a movie for the first time and show them how things have changed and how things are done, because it's hard to go out by yourself not knowing what you're walking into, and to have a person there to help you, that's a huge transition. But if you're a barber, offer an exoneree a haircut. You can write that off. You know, give us a gift card that somebody gave you and you threw it into a drawer. It doesn't have to necessarily be a monetary donation. And so building community, then we'll be able to say, hey, here's a dentist, here's a counselor, boom, boom, boom.
How did that organization get started and how did you get involved?
So this organization got started because when I were having a glass of wine and said, we need to do this. We should do this. We had community support and we had talked to some other exonerees that didn't have community support. And I filled out all the paperwork and I've literally built it. So it was a big deal when we got our 501c3 approval.
I live in Indiana and I would love to help in any way I can. And I'll send you my stuff via email, but I get a lot of people who email me who listen to this show who ask how they can help. Is there a way that the listeners can help your organization?
Yes, you can go to our website, www.justiceforjustus.org, all one word, no caps. And we have a contact sheet so that you can be on our contact list and tell us anything you feel like you can donate to help. And we will put that in our database. And there's also a donation link. There's links on there to lead back to our Facebook page. So we would love to build up more people, have them aware, and just keep getting more people involved.
And you said primarily you're in Indiana and Illinois right now?
Yes. You have to pay to be registered in other states. So since we're just on year one, my goal is to write grants. So hopefully we can get some funding to branch out to other states, and then we would hire another exoneree in that state to help build community efforts within that state. So hopefully we can branch out some more.
I love it. How do you think that your experience has changed your outlook on life?
I think it's made me more appreciative. Every day you see people rushing around, very hurried, very upset because they're not keeping track of their schedule, or, you know, the world just seems to run on this buzz and everybody's buzzing around doing things. And I get happy just walking outside barefoot with my cup of coffee and watching the dogs play.
What advice
little
do you have?
Little special moments.
Your little special moments. What advice do you have to anyone who might have been wrongly convicted of a crime?
Never give up. Never stop fighting. Never keep believing. And advice for somebody that hasn't been but is involved with any kind of police activity, get a lawyer. Get a lawyer up front. I don't care if you were just an innocent bystander. Get a lawyer.
And what do you think that listeners can do to help people who have been wrongly convicted?
Literally, average person, you can get involved with an organization that are helping with exonerees for reintegration. I mean, it's a huge misconception that there are reentry programs out there. Those reentry programs are for people with a conviction. So when I went in to file for reentry to get a quick crash course on 17 years, I was told I didn't qualify because I no longer had a conviction. So those kind of things are so necessary. Not every state has compensation. Not every state has programming out there to help somebody when they're released. So getting involved with organizations like mine, there are other ones out there, After Innocence, Life After Innocence, After Exoneration. And definitely if you have time to give as a lawyer, as an investigator, or money, all of our innocence programs need help. There are more people out there that don't have a lawyer yet.
Are you close with the people in your family now? How's your relationship with those people now?
I am close with my son as much as I can be. Him being 21, you know, he's living his own life and making his own mistakes. And I am just thankful that when it gets rough or hard, he still picks up the phone and reaches out to me. That's all I can ask for, I feel like, because so much time was stolen from us. So I'm thankful for what I can get. Clearly, I would love it if he lived with me and I could cook his meals every day and know everybody he's hanging around with, but yeah, that's not going to happen. So for him, for my brother, we're very close, but we were always close growing up. And so my incarceration and then my release just kind of made that more so, because I went through a lot of emotional turmoil when I was released that he dealt with the best way he could. And sometimes it was just simply giving me a shot of something, giving me a hug and telling me I needed to calm down. But the rest of my family, it's hard. You weren't there for so many years. So I'm talking to them and it's like I'm talking to strangers. I don't know what's happened in your life and you don't know who I am now. And there's all these expectations because when I get around them, they expect me to be the same person they knew 22 years ago. And that person left the day I went to prison.
I just want to say the person that you are now, I think is amazing because you could have taken your son and your brother and lived a quiet life, but instead you formed a nonprofit organization to help other people who'd been in your situation. And I think that that's amazing.
Well, thank you.
I feel really impressed when people who have been exonerated dedicate their free lives to helping people who are still being wrongly held or wrongly convicted. I just wondered how you felt about that.
Oh, no, I commend Christina for, you know, reaching out and doing what she's doing, starting organizations, and that's huge to try to help other people that's in the same situation that we were. I commend her.
You know, I know this really great podcast host that's doing something similar.
And she's great.
Oh, no. The person I'm talking about is a man. I think his name is DeMarco.
He's great, too.
He's fantastic. So until next time, Thank you so much for listening. Actual Innocence is hosted by DeMarco Carpenter and Brooke Giddings. Rough editing is done by Brooke, and master production is done by John Kerr. And our original music was made by Blake Maples. Thanks for listening.